Hello, and welcome to another episode of Chandra City TO, the podcast where we explore how to shape a better urban future in Toronto. I'm your host, Ian Montgomery, and today I have a bit of a two-for-one deal for you. Now, I originally asked just one person to speak with me about how we better foster the creative scene in Toronto, and then he said, wait, you have to include my cousin. So I guess we're keeping it in the family. Now, first up, we have Tabassum Siddiqui. She's a freelance journalist and communication specialist who's been at the forefront of Toronto's art and culture scene for over two decades. Her work spans across major media outlets like the Toronto Star, National Post, Globe and Mail, and the CBC, where she's covered everything from independent music to theatre, giving us a unique lens on the city's creative heartbeat. Alongside her, we have Fazil Siddiqui. He's the founder of The Creative Business Company, a global brand strategy firm based in the city. Fazil's best known for his work with Challenger Brands, and his keen insights into how cities can harness their unique strengths, innovate, and grow. After he spent a decade in the UK, he returned home to Toronto with a mission to revitalize how brands connect with their audiences. Today, we're diving into a conversation about what can make Toronto a challenger city in the realm of creativity, art, and culture. We'll discuss the current state of the city's creative scene, the challenges it faces, and the opportunities for growth. We'll also touch a little bit on how the city's diversity and innovation play crucial roles in shaping its future. So without further ado, let's get into the conversation. Thank you to you both for joining me on this, Fazil and Tab. Tab, I'm mostly thankful to you because Fazil, when I asked him to be on this, he's like, no, actually, can I bring a family member? Because I've got someone who'd be cooler and more interesting and more creative for you. So we'll have a little bit of a family battle on this one to see who's more cool and creative. Maybe people can vote on it at the end.
Oh, sounds good. But, you know, as his older cousin, sister, I think he's cool. So it's all good.
Thank you.
Fazil, obviously, I know you really well. Tab, this is the first time that we've actually chatted, but like before we get into this, it's a great chance just to have you guys introduce yourselves, a bit about you, your background, your life in Toronto, and go into it from there. So Fazil, I talk to you all the time, so you're not going first. So Tab, like tell myself and the handful of people who listen to this a little bit about you.
Yeah, of course. I'm Tabassum Siddiqui. I'm a freelance journalist and a communication specialist in Toronto, focusing mainly on arts and culture, and have done so for the past 22 years. And I got my start in that world in writing about music. So essentially the independent music scene in Toronto, which was really thriving at the time I started my career. So kind of got my feet wet in being a music writer and a critic, and then went on to be a news reporter for many, many years, always keeping a focus on arts and culture. And then eventually, as I added communications to my career, I got the chance to work with a lot of interesting arts and culture organizations. So that's been a real joy to bring both those sides of my work world together and kind of try to understand a little bit more also from the communications side where arts and culture is going in Toronto, especially as things have changed so much with digital disruption over the last sort of 10 to 15 years, if not longer. And right now I do a combination of both. So people always ask me, so where have you worked? And I just say, it's better to ask me where I haven't worked because I work with most of the major media in Toronto. Started off as print reporter, Toronto Star, National Post, Globe and Mail. Then went on to the CBC where I was a radio producer for many years at programs like Q, also Metro Morning, Here and Now. So I've gotten the chance to sort of like delve into all sorts of things and work with a lot of different people. And also that I feel has given me sort of a broader knowledge of the city and what's the sort of its trends and what's happening in arts and culture especially. And that just stems also from a passion of mine. Like music was my first love, but I've also ever since every aspect of culture in Toronto, it's a huge part of why I live here and what I love about it. And it's a little concerning to see some of the directions it's going in, but that's something we can talk about.
I want to make sure that when we go through this, we're still focusing on all the great stuff that's still here, but like here's the concerning thing. So let's take us out of that skid basically. Fazil, over to you.
Fazil Siddiqui, founder of Creative Business Company. It's a brand strategy firm based in Toronto and that works globally. A bit about my background. So I actually moved to Toronto 4 years ago. I grew up in Toronto originally, but then I spent a decade in the UK in London, and I worked at Profit. So Profit is a management consultancy that focuses on brand. And I suppose I became a bit kind of mini famous for working with challenger brands. So doing a lot of work with Formula E, Al Jazeera, Turkish Airlines, and some other kind of not challengers. And then I started my own firm about 4 years ago when I moved back to Toronto. And the basic idea was a lot of money over the past decade has been moving away from brand and towards performance marketing, which was seen as a bit more accountable, effective, and transparent. And rightly so, because I think a lot of the corporations and marketing teams were talking about brand wasn't really gaining the confidence of the C-suite. So I started my own firm with the mission to make brand more accountable and effective, because to grow sustainably, you need to invest in full funnel marketing. So that's just both brand and performance marketing. You can't hard sell the market the entire time. You need to warm them up. But to build a business case for brand, I think you need to talk about it in a different way. So we don't talk about like fuzzy stuff like, oh, our why and our purpose. We talk about future demand. We talk about versus current demand. We're very hard in talking about positionings and messaging and really tying brand to the funnel. So that's us today. And I suppose very much interested me to talking about this podcast is because whenever we go out, I'm the guy who's quite bullish on Toronto, but probably a bit more because I'm justifying why we moved 4 years ago and I convinced my wife not to go to Vancouver instead.
Good choice.
You've told me off a couple of times when I've got a little bit too critical of Toronto. So there's
that's been times, like
late at night, you sort of gone, no, these are really like good things that we should be really positive about. And I think like we need more people like you that correct some of the naysayers like me. So
you need more people with like a sunk cost is what you need.
I don't necessarily have those except for the fact that I lived here my entire life basically. But as Faisal is my cousin, we have cousins in Montreal, our whole section of a family there. And I feel like we've always had a little bit of a battle going on. And so we're the big like rah-rah Toronto people. It's hard to do when you're faced with Montreal, but we do it.
Having just been in Montreal the weekend, it is a tough battle to have. But what makes me really excited for this conversation, I feel like we have the sort of the strategy, big picture, brand and creative of the city, but then also like the actual, the grassroots and the arts and culture and the scene that really great challenger cities kind of have both of those things going on. To get it right, you can't just do it from the top down. You have to have it from the bottom up and then you have to sell the story of the whole thing. So that's why I think it's great to have like you guys as cousins, like talking about this. Maybe the best place to start, Tab, is like, what does Toronto do really, really well now when it comes to like its creative arts and culture scene? Like, what do you look at and think we should be really proud of this? This is some, oh, this is, might be something that we're not celebrating quite enough.
Oh, that's a great question. So just look at us. We're in the middle of summer. Any day of the week, there is something to do and at all cost levels, right? So free festivals, ticketed concerts, dance performances, theater. We have that whole 360 arts and culture scene in a way a lot of cities don't. And we do very well at all of it. I think that is something that people literally flock to cities for, right? Like just having that access to that arts and culture. And our diversity plays a big, big part in just that success of that world, right? So you can have anything from street festivals that are very focused on a particular sort of ethnic background, you know, something like Salsa in St. Clair, or you can have Afrofest, which brings in not just the local African musicians that come from diaspora all around the world, but musicians from their hometowns as well, which is amazing that you get to see them all in a beautiful park for free. So things like that are just sort of unmatchable almost anywhere. I mean, you have them in larger cities like New York, which are, you know, other cities that are similar to Toronto, but we do it those kind of things very particularly well, I find. The other thing is, as a big market, we have a lot of the touring that's coming through, more so than almost any other city, definitely in Canada, but even among some of the bigger US markets. So any big tour you want to see of a music artist, for example, that is like anything from the largest, the biggest blockbuster superstars to just sort of the emerging artists, they're all going to be coming through here. And then the local scene, you know, in terms of music, it's like that development and being able to see a show at venues just right across the city anytime you want. That's so exciting for a lot of people that they really have a stake in wanting to do that as part of their lives. You know, it's funny because like, I mean, I write about music, so I'm very involved in that particular scene. But I have friends who are around our age who say, you still go to shows? And I'm like, yeah, you know, like, because I can, you know, everything from something I don't know about them just popping in for free to check it out to something I've looked forward to for weeks and bought the ticket, you know? So I think we're very lucky that way. And there's a wide range of just options in the city.
How do you think it's changed over time? So like, I've had that chat with somebody the other day who was sort of, they were more of a DJ and saying that the club scene's kind of died a lot or declined in Toronto. How do you feel about the city in 2024 compared to 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Do you feel like, what trajectory do you think we're on?
Yeah. And I think that that's a really good question because venues is an issue. So venues have closed right across the city in a really, really major way in the last sort of 10 to 15 years. And that's just a matter of everything from just audiences to finances to also just real estate, right? Like just look at recently, the Phoenix Concert Theater just announced, oh, it's a storied venue in the city. It's been around for decades. It announced it's closing. It is looking for a new place to park itself. I mean, whether they can find it at an affordable rate in something like Toronto right now is anyone's guess. But they're closing partly because why? Condos, right? Like that site's been bought up. And that story has been, we can tell it over and over again. And the minute we lose venues, you also lose that incubator for creativity, for being able to host emerging artists. So something like the club scene or the electro scene, which was really, really big in Toronto, especially in the early 2000s, that was partly because there were all sorts of small experimental venues in which people were applying their craft, right? So I look back, I was reading Denise Benson, who's a great writer. And here's something that's also interesting. Alt weeklies, those newspapers that everybody would pick up once a week, we don't even have any at the city anymore. But those were a huge harbinger of being able to discover new music. And Denise Benson was a columnist at iWeekly. She's written a book about the venues that we had and that we've lost. And I was reminded recently about just how many of those small venues had these DJs that were just up and coming that are now quite well known in the music world. So somebody like Caribou, who was known as Manitoba back in the day, he was just like spinning records, just kind of doing his thing, even kind of trying out what he eventually would go on to do in these tiny, tiny little like clubs that would host maybe 100, 150 people. And he was able to do that because there were so many and they existed. And it was all a little microcosm. So, and then as an example, my scene, which is, I was part of a little bit of that, but my scene was mostly sort of the indie rock scene. So you're here now of bands like Broken Social Scene or Metric or Feist, all of them were just coming up at the time and sort of like 99 to 2005 or so. And the reason they were able to do it, quite frankly, was that there were these pocket-sized little clubs all over the place, College Street, Dundas Street, that they were able to just book a gig even the night before and say, hey, bring 20 friends, we'll do it. Let's just try it out, you know? And that's how they made their market, but that's also how they made their scene. They were able to collaborate together. They were able to be really creative and doing so without having to worry a lot about the money involvement in the sense of like, yes, it would be great if they were getting paid, but were they getting paid a lot? Probably not. But the venues at the same time were also not expecting that huge payday that we're, this is what we're seeing now, right? Where ticket sales are just skyrocketing through the roof in the sense of like the prices. Even availability sometimes is a real factor, right? And of course, we can talk about monopolies and Ticketmaster and all of that. But really, even on a smaller scale, when you lose venues, you have a real sort of tightening of the market and the consolidation that doesn't allow for as much experimentation and creativity on that grassroots level.
This is like makes me think of that divide that you have of the venues have declined. There's less of them. They're harder to access. But we live in a world where it's never been easier to connect with people through the internet. So you kind of have musicians that find their scene and they find their niche through just putting out tracks that they've recorded in their spare bedroom and they build up community that way. But like what we've gained in one creative community, we've lost in the sort of the physical realm. And that's, to me, that's a problem because you want both. One wasn't meant to be a replacement for the other.
Yeah, very well said. I mean, and that's part of that whole digital disruption that is still reverberating till today, right? I mean, look, we saw in the pandemic that we crave coming together. And there's nothing like live music in the sense of like having all those people in a room. And that is a very different experience, certainly, than like discovering like your favorite artist on Spotify or something like that, which is great, as you say, like that needs to be there as well. Like one doesn't replace the other. And so to not have as much of the physical, the live, the venue side of things has, I think, in a lot of ways been detrimental to young artists who maybe it's a needle in haystack online, right? Young artists come to me all the time and say, how can I do it? What should I do? Should I be on TikTok? What should, you know, how do I really like break through? A lot of it, quite frankly, is luck. A lot of it is hard work. A lot of it's maybe getting the right people behind you. You know, like maybe you have a firm like Vessels that's like helping market you, something like that. But ultimately, it doesn't replace that grassroots on the ground. Somebody heard you and the next day they're bringing five people because they're like, you have to hear the singer like the next time they play here, you know? And so many people, especially in the early 2000s, that's how they came up. A great example I mentioned earlier, Feist, like that singer, the minute she started performing around Toronto, I remember just that electricity of that feeling of like, you don't understand, like everyone I know, you have to come see this singer. So, you know, and then she'd play so often, you'd just go see her and it would just get exponentially bigger and bigger, you know? And I find like it's fewer and far between now that that can actually happen.
It's not just we're getting old and we're like, oh, it was so much better when we were young and we were going out to venues.
I was going to say, there's certainly a nostalgia element in looking back this way sometimes. And I try to insulate myself a little bit from that. And I don't want to be that guy. But while that's absolutely true, and I think especially when it comes to art and music and the things that you love, like, of course, you're going to hold like all those discoveries really dear. But at the same time, I think we shouldn't not look at the structural issues that are kind of behind some of the things that are concerning.
Wonder if as well, there's a parallel within the world of food and chefs and restaurants. I think this is going to be a very, very middle class story of one based on kind of what I see in my neighborhood. But in Cabbage Town, there's often the discourse is like, why hasn't Parliament Street become more of a hotbed of restaurants? And the answer from some of the business owners has always been that the lot sizes have been tremendously large. So what that does is it creates a certain cost of entry such that you have to be a chef backed with a considerable amount of money to actually get a foothold in. Now, conversely, and also compared to the music scene, at the same time, there's far more opportunities for young chefs to do like pop-up stuff and food trucks and what have you. So I'd almost argue it's not the kind of seed stage where the issue is. It's maybe I'd put this forth as a hypothesis. Is it more the scale phase? So how do you go from like initially setting up to growing and developing a bit more of a profile for yourself? Now, interestingly, one of the answers that have popped up as well, and from a kind of unpopular source, has been on some of the developers who are creating some of the buildings around Regent's Park, and that has its own set of issues around kind of gentrification, what have you. But one of the things that is exciting is that they're exploring the concept of micro retail. So along Gerrard Street, there's going to be many, 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 many storefronts for commercial use with 50 to 150 square feet. Now, that for me seems like a very interesting way to deal with some of those issues that we talked about. Now, whether it actually gets done, whether the number of units is what they promise, I don't know. But it seems to me that there's potentially some solutions that could be found there.
I think there's a really interesting thing for Toronto of that. You talk about food. Toronto is possibly one of the best cities in the world, maybe when it comes to diversity. Like, you can basically eat anything you want from any regional cuisine within any region. It's not just, oh, I want Mexican food. If you say, oh, I want food from the Yucatan, you can go get it. But like, one of the challenges is knowing where to find it. Sometimes it's being able to get to it. Certain types of cuisine, you'd like, there's a great Latin American place, but it's like a 35-minute drive north of the city. Sometimes it's getting to those places. I think it's really interesting in Toronto that like the creativity, whether it's in music, whether it's in art and culture, whether it's in food, it does exist. And we'd be lying if you said it didn't, but it's sometimes like discovering it or getting to it becomes like one of the hardest pieces.
And there's so much right there, right? I mean, when we talk about like sort of ethnic food, if you want to call it that, the GTA has just become this gargantuan thing where it's like one Scarborough on one end, almost Mississauga, a whole separate city on the other end. And that's where those two corners, the West and the East, are really where you're getting a lot of those people making that very traditional, very like the food directly from their homeland. Why can they do that? Real estate, right? I mean, it's so much more affordable to be in those pockets of areas. And even those are becoming more expensive. But that also lends itself to some experimentation in the way that it maybe doesn't downtown, like Faisal was saying about the lots, or even just the price of something like that square footage. If you're a young chef coming up and your dream is to open something like that, like you're gambling a lot to be able to do that, right? If you look at the stats, something like 70-80% of restaurants fail in Toronto in their first year. To me, when I read that, I was just like, that is a wild number. But it's not surprising, right? It's a really tough business with narrow margins. But again, like the creativity and just the experimentation, all that is there. It's just so hard to do when a city's getting increasingly unaffordable, really.
I think there's an interesting regulation thing there. Like, I just finished rereading Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential. And like you're going, it's a lot of it is the 70s, 80s, early 90s of New York restaurants, most of which he seemed to drive into the ground because he was too busy snorting coke and injecting heroin. But there's something kind of interesting about that. Like, you see the historical things and you're like, was it way, way easier to open a restaurant because the real estate was cheaper, because the regulation was much more lax, or people were just breaking the rules and not necessarily like caring about what the city thought of them because the city was less efficient? I don't know. But I think there's something really interesting around like the, how easy can you make it for these people to get something started, be compliant, and then if it works, the market will tell us. And if it doesn't work, the market will tell us. But you don't want that to be like ruin somebody's economic future because one risk they took didn't work out, right?
Oh, 100%. Even as one of the biggest Toronto boosters around, I think the one thing we often don't do well is like the bureaucracy and red tape involved in a lot of these things, right? Like everything from opening a venue to starting a new restaurant. You know, like I have family and friends in Europe that come here sometimes and they're just like, did you just say this train is not going to be built until 7 or 8 years. Like, years? Is that what you just said? They don't get it. They don't get it at all, you know, because it just does not work that way in the places that they're from. And as Torontonian, it often becomes really hard to be just kind of say, yeah, I'm sorry. This is just the way it works here.
Yeah, I was, I still think a lot of these issues, if we go back to what Todd was talking about with the music scene, on one hand, there's an interesting dichotomy. The venues aren't there, but equally, it's easier to get discovered online, and the tools to make music have been somewhat democratized. In the same way with the food scene, everyone has access to a kind of a pop-up. There's so many businesses that were started on Facebook, but yet people can't get a hold into actual affordable restaurant space. So I put forth the assertion maybe that like it's less about kind of starting, it's more about kind of scaling, that middle phase of the growth continuum. I was reading an interesting article on, it was an article, it was actually a YouTube video produced by the Financial Times, but on why the London Stock Exchange, for example, is struggling to attract more businesses to IPO there. It's a lot more profitable to IPO on say, the S&P, and you make more money and so on and so forth. And one of the reasons why was they were saying that a lot of British firms are very good at starting within the seed stage, but they're lacking funding within that scaling stage. And one of the reasons why the size of the London Stock Exchange, perhaps, and the amount of capital flowing through it is not as big as other exchange markets is that pension fund money in the UK is actually severely underinvested within their own country. Compare that to the pension funds, you know, the OPP here, or not the Ontario Teachers Pension Fund, or some of the other pension funds in the US. They're heavily invested in local domestic markets. And when they are invested in local domestic markets, some of that capital flows down into the companies within that country and on those exchanges. So anyways, where I'm going with that is I do feel that the Gerrard Street example, where you have developers working in conjunction with, I know it's a platitude, but like I do think it's going to be a public and private model, some form of cooperation between the two that perhaps gives the best chance for a lot of these companies to grow within that kind of scaling stage and make some of that capital and some of that opportunity trickle down.
I love that point because I've actually got somebody who's coming on this next week to talk about capital and design. Well, how that's going to be so important about how we fund the future growth of cities.
Yeah, I have a very predictable one, which I think you'll hear from a lot of artists, but Berlin is just sort of known for being a creative city, a city that's really great for the arts, especially music. Again, music is kind of my area, but also for visual arts, for theater. And that's partly cost of living. They have made it so artists can actually work and live in the city in a way that works for them. And that's everything from affordable studio space to like abundance of venues of all sizes to rent. I mean, Montreal in Canada is another example of a city that's really leaned heavily on its art scene and vice versa for years because housing was more affordable. Toronto Arts Council and Foundation in 2019 put out a research report looking at Toronto, and 70% of the several thousand artists that they surveyed said they were considering leaving Toronto in the coming years. And why was that? Simply cost of living. They just could not keep up with being able to say, for example, rent a studio for a couple hundred dollars a month while also keeping up with their apartment and their cost of living, their rent. And that is a scary stat. I think when that report came out, that was just one example of many that, I mean, anecdotally, that's been the case for many, many years. But having some research that we can actually point to from, you know, the city's funding body for artists was really important because it was a bit of a wake-up call for the fact that how do you sustain a city that likes to pride itself on being an arts and culture city or a creative city when the majority of your artists are saying, I don't know that I can live and work here. That's a problem. So when you look to cities like Berlin, even Mexico City is really beefed up their arts and culture scene in recent years. And partly that's also very similar factors at play there. So when you look at all these three examples, Berlin, Montreal, Mexico City, they are very cognizant that cost of living is tied to having that healthy and thriving creative scene. Because ultimately, if you can't do your day-to-day and make your ends meet, how are you making art at the same time? It's not feasible. So I think Toronto has a ways to go in trying to start thinking very seriously now about when people are being priced out of their own city, how do you then maintain this reputation for being a hotbed for arts and culture? It's a difficult thing, and it's one that our policymakers are going to have to take very seriously in the next 5 to 10 years.
Dumb question, though. Why is there a thriving arts and culture scene in New York or London when property prices are super high there?
I mean, honestly, it's a scale. Go back to your word, right? It's New York is just so much bigger in a lot of ways than we are. I just came back from New York just about a week ago. And it's funny because I really love New York of all the American cities that I visit. And part of that is simply just like how vibrant in the arts and culture scene that it is there, right? But that being said, I often like to compare it to Toronto, and then I realize it's so much bigger in so many different ways. Everything from population to venues to just like the audience that's available for all the things that are on offer, right? So also, I think bringing it back to policy and government and just sort of the people that are the decision makers, when your city is sort of, especially like New York, known for certain like arts and culture, but really certain sectors of arts and culture, theater, music, even art, just visual arts, you know, the museum scene there is absolutely massive. Your decision makers have to understand and realize like paying attention to those sectors in a very tangible way is going to be part of your economic lifeblood. And I think Toronto, one thing we haven't always done well is really keep that in mind. I mean, if you look at, you know, people may have varying opinions about Richard Florida's work on the creative class, but I think what he did really well in sort of bringing that idea to light, in the past sort of decade plus is remind people, if you want to have a city that has that thriving arts and culture scene as part of its economic engine, you actually have to walk that talk, so to speak, right? And we're not always very good at that. I think Toronto is so focused sometimes on sort of the nitty gritty and just, you know, and I think we've seen a decline even in that, everything from like garbage collection to the beautification of the streetscape. And so when those things are barely being handled really well, things like arts and culture, which can often be seen as a frill from voters, are not always the front and center priority.
One of the things I found interesting was of the freelancers that I've used for my firm, some of the most successful have been immigrants to Toronto. So there's a couple of videographers I've used who come from France, a few designers who've come from the UK. And I think, interestingly, I've asked them, like, why'd you leave Paris? Paris is a pretty kind of hip place for design and culture. And what he said was that there was a bit of a glass ceiling, given his racial background. Or another person I talked to who came from the UK said something to the effect that the class structure is still very apparent. And I felt like I had more opportunity in Canada. And weirdly enough, it feels like there's a kind of moment within which you have to capture them. Because interestingly, that the videographer from France went and moved recently to Montreal. So it almost feels like there's the kind of reputational halo is very much in Toronto's advantage, but it can be quickly kind of, once a reality sets in, we certainly don't want to just be a feeder for other cities.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really, really good point. I think you're seeing, even on the wider, sort of broader political sphere now, like so many people are saying, especially people that are coming from elsewhere, they see the province of Canada. They maybe heard about it from others. They really appreciate things like our diversity that we have in a way that's unlike a lot of other places. But they come here and that really hard reality sets in. And then that trickle down effect of like either people moving elsewhere to different cities and like not that staying in Toronto, and we really need them. Or even politically, I think we're going to be seeing the ramifications of that coming up soon where people don't feel like, they're like, well, I came here. I felt like I was going to get ahead, but I'm just not. So that's a problem. I don't feel like these people, these leaders or these policymakers are working for me. So maybe I'll try voting for the other guys, you know, maybe they'll do something better. But at the same time, even within that framework, we're not seeing actually great ideas or policies or just the, you know, like platforms from any corners that are really exciting enough for folks who worry about things like being able to make opportunities in the arts or culture or even adjacent media marketing. Creative fields, are they hearing from our purported leaders about like where's the imagination? Where's the creativity on that front? I'm not seeing a ton of it yet. I'd be curious to see by the time we sort of like get into the next even local elections, but even federally, like what are you going to do? That we are seeing people feel that they're not getting ahead in those fields, whereas like their creativity is there. Personally, they have it in spades, right? But they're not being given sort of some of the opportunities that they need in order to actually succeed.
I think we're in this really messy place where some people have chased really simple solutions. And I don't want to go too politically, but I think we have an opposition at the moment that loves to say, this is wrong, this is wrong, this sucks, this is broken. And to be fair, they're right. there's not an awful lot of how to fix it. But when we do hear the how to fix it, we kind of hear, oh, we don't have enough housing, let's build more housing. But if you look in the press recently, like the last week or two, people are like, here's lots of glass condos built above Square One in Mississauga or built in downtown Toronto that were listed at $1 million and they still can't sell for 700,000. And there's no one prepared to rent them at the rates that the investor landlord really wants for it. And we've built all these condos, but we've built 1 and 2 bedroom condos in big towers. But we've not built condos for families. We've not built condos for artists. We've not built condos that fit different kinds of lifestyles or different needs. And then those condo spaces, we have this on another podcast, but the boxes at the bottom fit a Shoppers Drug Mart and a TD Bank. They don't fit a recording studio. They don't fit a theater space. They don't fit a restaurant going from pop-up to first permanent. I think it's really interesting that the conversation around creativity and arts and culture shows us it's not about just a blunt solution to the problem. You actually need a more creative solution to a more complicated and nuanced problem. And I'm really glad that surfaced.
I think you've hit on it exactly right there, right? I think one thing that Toronto still struggles at and has for a long time is just that imagination. So like, okay, so we're building all these glass condos. Why couldn't a recording studio be on the bottom floor of one of those? We make it so hard for that to happen, just like a sheer sort of bureaucracy and policy framework, that you're putting barriers in people's way instead of actually working hand in hand with them to say, no, actually, that would be an amazing thing. Let's do it. And I've never quite, it's maybe above my pay grade, but I've never quite been able to figure out, like, how is it that we do that? And why is it that we do that? And why cannot we harness some of the creativity that we have just on the ground in so many different genres and businesses and be able to help them actually realize their vision?
I think that's the thing that London and New York, to come back to why can London and New York do this? Is yes, they're bigger. But like, I think the GTA is further across than London is across in sort of geography. But I think what London has is more resilience around types of buildings and uses and zoning. And we get into that realm. And like New York has, I look at Brooklyn Navy Yards and just how that has developed over time from being like end of the earth to now being like a really creative and industrial, awesome space. I think that resilience is something that Toronto hasn't done. Toronto chased the condo boom, which is maybe that's the missed opportunity, but that's the thing we have to take advantage of before more people like freelance for phase or like end up taking off and going to Montreal or back to France or wherever.
I think also, this is going to sound very harsh, but I don't think we have politicians who are culturally literate or sophisticated. If you look at any of the City of Toronto long-term vision plans, I don't see a broader definition of livability. That's what I was just checking now. I remembered that before, but we define livability in terms of access to a park or how many baseball parks you have within a certain square mile radius. But I don't think we're thinking about livability with a capital L. And how do arts, how do music, and when we talk about arts, by the way, we're not talking about, public graffiti that's co-sponsored by the City of Toronto in random places across the city. And I think when you think about a broader definition about livability, you think about intergenerational communities, you think about mixed use, you think about different types of businesses within hubs brought together. It sounds kind of like Montreal a bit. It feels like it's this small C conservatism that is pervasive within a lot of the planning visions for the city. And personally, I would suggest hiring a chief creative officer, a chief culture officer, maybe they have, I don't know if they have or have not, and actually give them some leverage and some power to shape policies. And so within the long-term visions of the city, if we say that livability is one of the pillars, what are the knock-on effects of that? So how are we going to allocate money to some of those things and how do we bring those to life?
I love the idea of a chief creative officer. I mean, if you look at Berlin and a couple other cities, they have a night mayor. So that's a person just kind of responsible for like the nightlife. And when we think of Berlin, we think of the clubs, but it's not just the clubs, right? Like it's that whole cityscape that like comes alive at night. And I mean, talk to someone who moves to Toronto from like small town Alberta. Why are they coming here? Are they coming here to live in a glass tower? I mean, maybe, but I think they're coming here for the culture, for the everything from the food to the music to the what they can just take in a big city like ours. And you lose out on that when that experience is not consistently nurtured and given room to develop and grow.
Mm-hmm. I think we have so much of the components, we just haven't stitched them together. I come back to the food thing of like, I really want to go for Afghan food tonight, but do I want to, how do I schlep over to Scarborough without driving there? And if I drive there, I'm going to be sat in traffic. That's not great. Or creating this, the space for downtown to be for someone on the first recording we had of this, she talked about turning downtown from a 9 to 5 to a 5 to 9 kind of place. I think that we have lots of the stuff. It's then not stitched together. And that's why the chief culture, the chief creative officer, great, we should just do that. I hope that's one of the things that come out at the end of this, if people pay attention to us.
I think we also have to a narrative for the city. I think the city often talks about diversity, but that's the what, that's not the so what. And so I'd love to be able to paint a picture of why people should come to the city. What does it offer that is unique and different? What is that flavor? And how do you build a sense of identity around that? I remember when my wife moved to the city, my brother said, Toronto has no nines, but it has a whole bunch of sixes and sevens. Which is kind of true in certain aspects, but I think there's a narrative around that. You can explain why that's a good thing, why that creates a more equitable and just city. If you think about Ronald Reagan, he was a wonderful storyteller. Peggy Noonan was a famous speechwriter, and he framed the U.S. in the 1980s. No, I'm not a big fan of Reaganomics, but as a shining city on a hill, as vivid, wonderful imagery. And why can't we have a bit of that when we talk about the city Toronto? We want it to be. And I think we need to do more than just say it's diverse.
That's a fantastic point. Yeah. Because I think that framing that we've had for so long, it's so easy to kind of coast on that. And exactly what you're saying, what does that mean? I mean, if you can't drive home that story and that narrative to people, then it just becomes sort of meaningless mush, right? I think every time I travel, which I'm doing a little bit more of these days, the minute I come home or even before I come home, I'm struck by Toronto being this really fascinating experiment that's unlike almost anywhere else. And I live here, so I take it for granted in so many ways, right? But the minute you leave and you realize, New York is similar, but it's not the same, right? And what makes it not the same? So being able to sort of pinpoint that and really drive it home and tell that story, I think is super important in so many ways, not just for what we're talking about here in terms of arts and culture or creativity, but in tourism and just even the way we're attracting people to the city. It's really, really important.
I 100%, even then, I think Toronto is a more diverse city than New York or London. And I've kind of lived in both places, and I'll tell you why. It's not pockets of diversity. It's everywhere. It's in the corridors of power. I'm in an interracial relationship. My wife is Caucasian, and no one bats an eye. And I think that you listen to so many different languages on the street. It's like fresh air. And if we actually believe that that is a strength, apparently it is the motto of the city, I don't think we pay that off. We don't say, to Tab's point, what is the benefit of that? How do you feel that? What opportunities will that give to you on a day-to-day basis? And by the way, if that's a pillar of the city, if belonging, that's one way you can go in. Okay, how do we actually foster that economically? I think we're at this kind of sloganeering level. What we're not in the how do we drive policy from that position.
I've talked to you about this before, Faisal, but you kind of have this statistically, Toronto is one of, if not the most diverse cities in the world by where people have come from. I think the point you make around diversity around in places of power, so true. There's actually more people from different places and different backgrounds in positions of power in Toronto than you see in most other cities. Other diverse cities, the power circles are still the people who are there, not originally, but you know what I mean, who've been there for a while. But I still find Toronto has this diversity issue where people come from everywhere, but end up looking quite similar in Toronto. You'll see people from different backgrounds, but they're dressed in this kind of the same way. Whereas if you went to Montreal that's statistically less diverse, it's more confident. So people will wear things that you wouldn't see people wearing in Toronto because people would look at them funny. And I think that's the thing that when I go back to London, there's more weirdos on the street in London in terms of how people are looking, how people are talking, that you wouldn't necessarily, people in Toronto would be like, that's weird, even if that's kind of their cultural background. And I think that's a really strange thing that Toronto needs to get over itself, because we celebrate our diversity, but in some ways we sort of we like to be tick the box of diversity, but we don't necessarily let people be their real true selves here. I think that's a huge challenge, says the middle-aged white guy.
It goes back to a little bit of what Faisal was saying about the typical small C Toronto conservatism, right? That underscores it completely. That's a great example that you're giving, Ian, because there's still a certain element. Like Toronto used to have a motto, Toronto the good, right? We're not the best motto for any city, really, if you think about it. But it really says a lot about how Toronto saw itself, even its roots and sort of like that very uptight Presbyterian sort of like model that the city was founded on. And we've come so far from that. And yet we cling really tightly, I think, in some ways to that notion.
I want to put you both on the spot because we didn't talk about this beforehand. But if you were to try and like tell the story of Toronto or what Toronto should be, what would you try and make to be like the, would it, whether it's the tagline or the strategy or the story, what do you think that really is or should be for Toronto if it's going to be a challenger city? And I know the real answer is the city should pony up some money and pay the creative business company to do this as a piece of work.
I was going to say, you need to pay me for that.
But let's just throw it out there as a little bit of a teaser as we come towards the end of this episode.
Yeah, going back to what I said, I think we really need to sell just what a unique experiment Toronto is in so many ways, and one that succeeded. And that partly a lot of that has to stem with the diversity, the really real, just very basic fact that Faisal was talking about like the way that we have people from all over the world and it's not siloed. I think a lot of other places have that sort of demographic diversity, but it is very siloed. It just doesn't exist in the same way that it does here. And part of that is just part of the Canadian multicultural experience that we've had since the 70s, obviously. But Toronto is not Calgary, is not Edmonton, is not even Vancouver, you know? So what makes us unique and special and different is partly that diversity, but it's also how we've come together as a city in that way to make it that place, right? And that's to do with the people. It's like, you know, we've kind of pointed out some of the flaws of sort of the policymaking and the politics and everything else today on the podcast. But ultimately, the strength of any city is its people. And that goes for Toronto about 1,000%. And I don't know that we always do really well in lifting ourselves up and telling that story that way.
I like that. There you go. Someone started it, said Faisal. So now you can bring it home.
I'll say something a bit controversial. I think if you think about a brand and the different elements and what we play up and what we play down, I think we should actually play down the Canadianness. In a world that is becoming more authoritarian, more rightward leaning, less hospitable, I think we should position Toronto as the world's kind of metropolis. This is the place where the best of the world can come. People who are tolerant, people who are hardworking, people who are ambitious. It is the world city. And so this is less about, I don't give a fuck about granola bars and hockey and Tim Hortons. Forget all of that stuff. Like Hamilton can have that. Let them run with that within their brand guidelines. I think it's less about being Canadian. I think it's about being the world city. And admitting that this is like, it's a grand experiment, to Thubu's point. Right? It is not the finalized product. And wouldn't you want to kind of come here and help write that story? You know, famously, Jane Jacobs came from the US and moved up to Toronto. One of the attributes of Toronto is that because it tends to be, we have a very weak kind of mayoralty, a lot of decision-making can actually happen from a bottoms-up community perspective. So it was a bunch of communities that actually pushed back against building of the Spadina Highway. That needs to be our story. Like any good brand story, it's like a slightly bigger pair of clothes that you grow into. It doesn't have to be us right now, but it needs to be who we want to be. And I think who we want to be is far more than a kind of Benetton commercial mixed with a Tim Hortons commercial. So I think it's far more ambitious. This is the place to be. Remember why people come here. This is a place where who you were has no bearing on who you can be. And that's ambitious. And I think that's future-facing, and it's exciting, and all of those great things.
It reminds me a little bit, and I don't mean this in a sort of we've been there before way, but like the license plates on for Ontario used to say a place to grow. And actually, like, that was a really good tagline, but it was always felt like it was a tagline without any substance beneath it. If you turn that into something where it's your story and your strategy actually have things that are going on that mean that, and you can point to the people who've been through that journey, that's amazing. I just think we have a bit of reflection and fixing to a bit of work to do to get that back.
It's super hopeful though that people are like yourselves and so many others are thinking about that though. I think, you know, if we're coming at this from a place of, first of all, I talk about this all the time. Like there's so many people that are like, this is broken with the city or this is wrong, or we're just like a lot of grousing. And that's all very well and good. We got to do that too. But if you believe in the city, if you want to live here, if this is your home, how are you also thinking and working to make it the place that you want to be, that you want it to be? And I know like what Faisal is saying, I think makes me so hopeful because I think there are so many people that are thinking about these things and want it to be that place that we know that it is and it can be. Even conversations like this, I think, are really exciting because there's so much potential. And sometimes I feel like we're kind of in this weird stagnant place, but it doesn't have to be that way.
I'll let you in on a secret. Any hiring that I do locally in Canada, I look at newer Canadians because they've got hunger, they've got ambition, they've got drive. They're not thinking about fucking off to the cottage at 4 p.m. on a Thursday. And that's where the excitement is for me in this city and in this country. And I think that's where the answer is going to be as well.
So I think you're touching on that a little bit, but I like to end these things on, if you can wave the magic wand and make the wish or the command that one day I will Google whether it's a wish or a command, what would you do with that magic wand? What would be the one thing that you would say, like, that's what I want to see?
I think I'm going to take it back to what I was saying before about just opening up pathways for the people who are creative, who are already doing great work and have great ideas to succeed. And that can be anything from getting rid of the bureaucracy to helping those recording studios get in the bottom floor of the condo, to making sure that we have recording studios for artists, to making sure that we have that studio space for a painter that's affordable and that they can actually just pay their exorbitant rent, but still be able to make their work, you know? And I think if we don't do that, there is a real danger in losing the very people that we need to keep this in creative city.
I agree with that.
I'm reminded a bit about what Suresh Das did for the city. For those listeners who don't know, Suresh Das is he's a food writer for the CBC, for the Toronto Star. And what he became kind of famous for was shining light on the suburbs and really saying that that's where the best food in the city is. And I think you should be given the Order of Canada, because what he did was he actually made us look at the things that we took for granted and say, hey, this is world-class what we have here. And he made us reassess the strip mall that looked like nothing, that we always, you know, went past and like begrudged, didn't look cool, or was like Montreal. He's like, no, there's really great places here. So I'd say I take inspiration for that. The one thing that I would do is wave a wand is to get people to realize how the immense, immense talent and world-class talent we already have here in this city. It is already there. We just need to platform it. We need to showcase it far better. Like how you have real estate companies like the CBRE sitting on hundreds of thousands of empty office spaces in downtown Toronto with no one in it. And all of that stock's going to collapse anytime soon. But those real estate companies are sitting on those things because somehow they think everyone's going to go back to work when they're not. Use that space, turn it into art galleries, give places for artists to do interesting things. Make it turn into places where businesses can do things together and not in that kind of overly cheap kind of orchestrated incubator type things that we have in the city. Do stuff with the things that we have and be creative around that and know that we have the talent in our city. Our film industry is some of the best in the world. Like, let's stop thinking about it as just a cheaper set for New York, right? So we have all of the talent in the city. We just need to stop being so a bit Canadian about it and being a bit shy about talking about ourselves as world-class. Like Creative Business Companies, I'd argue one of the top 5 brand firms in the world. And we say that to our clients. So I think other people need to do that as well.
I totally concur with everything. It's having the space, unleashing, and having the confidence to go do something with it. So you guys have fired me up. Thank you.
Rah, rah, rah.
This all starts with like ranty stuff on LinkedIn from me that I'm like, right, no, this has to be turned into something more productive and purposeful. I'm really glad there's people who are like kind of feeling in a similar way to me, but have this optimism of what we can do. So hopefully we can do something cool with it.
And look, at just as we said, you're someone that's actually doing something about it. So that's half the battle right there. So yeah. Thank you.
We need more kind of Americana to go with the rah-rah-rah. You know, you're like born in the USA. We need like a Toronto version of that. We need the Stars and Stripes. We need like an eagle. We need like a
remember the Northern Touch rap single?
Hell
we
yes.
need that, but for Toronto. Yeah.
Socrates.
This is what I thought when I moved here. I thought like Canada was like, you had just the right amount of reservedness and formality and sort of like underplaying things that a British person has with just yep. the right amount of like brash and confidence that the Americans have. But sometimes they get a bit muddled up in it. We need to tone. Sometimes Canada's been too British and sometimes it's not being enough American and vice versa.
Yeah, they're sleeping through an opportunity, right? There's a window right now
where the world is on fucking fire, right? The US is going to go down a very, very weird path, like a very constitutionally weird path in September and October. In the UK, okay, fine, the Tories are out, but that was 10 years of atrophying the public system and defunding it. You also have a class hierarchy that is suffocating. France was very much flirting with a very, very dark future. Like, now is our time to talk about ourselves. It is a window where we can capture the world's imagination, its talent, and its capital. If we sleep through this moment right now, we've been lost it for a generation. So we have a very unique point in time for us to kind of sing our tune, and we need to do it now.
There is a bit of a now and ever moment for Toronto here. You're right, just totally right.
I think there is.
We have a band from Toronto called Metric that has a single called Now or Never Now. So we can use that as our anthem.
Fun fact, I actually named my business Now or Never. Faisal's got to plug the creative business company. I named my business Now or Never partly because of that big song, because it was in my head time I was conceiving. So.
Synergy, everybody. Synergy. I love it.
Correct.
Yeah, they're one of my faves. I love them.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Challenger City TO. If you liked it, please do share. If you didn't, well, don't keep that negativity to yourself. Please do let me know why. We really want conversations that inspire positive change, so all that feedback makes this series better and better as we go on. And without further ado, we look forward to seeing you for another episode very soon. Thank you.